Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Tuesday afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're expecting sunny skies through the rest of the day around the valley with a high of 110. Should be clear and dry tonight with lows in the mid-80s, and then sunny and dry tomorrow with a high of 108. Currently sunny skies and 104 in the valley. In valley traffic, an accident I-10 westbound at 35th Avenue is blocking the right lane. Also watch out for a collision on the 202 eastbound. That's at 32nd Street. For a number of years, the Arizona Corporation Commission has been a comfortable panel for Republicans. The last time a Democrat successfully won a commission seat was in 2008, when Paul Newman and Sandra Kennedy were victorious. But the current makeup of the commission is 5 Republicans and 0 Democrats. There are 3 seats up for election this year. All 3 Republicans are running to be elected, and they're being challenged by just 2 Democrats. So why only 2 Democrats for 3 seats? With me to talk about that is Evan Wyloge of the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. Evan, what's the strategy behind this?
We had observed in a few election cycles in the past the way that parties had done what's called a single shot in some of the legislative races. And there are some ideal kind of scenarios for doing that. But what we saw this time around is that the Democratic Party is running only 2 candidates for 3 available Corporation Commission seats. And so we wanted to take a look into how that can change things from a sort of mathematical perspective.
So when the math comes out, does it make sense for Democrats to try this sort of thing? Does it give them, potentially in this case, a better chance of winning?
Well, it definitely rules out that they're going to win 3 seats. I mean, that's for sure.
Right.
But it also increases the odds that they will win at least 1 seat. And that has to do with the fact that, they're the underdog party here in the state. They're outnumbered by Republicans and also by independent voters who outnumber all registered partisan voters, and then a couple of concepts like the way that Democrats may, instead of using all 3 of their available votes, only cast 2 votes for the 2 Democrats, which lowers the total number of votes that will be cast in that race, and then also the way that things get affected when you look at the combinations of split ticket possibilities, because when you've got 2 Democrats and 3 Republicans, more possibilities favor getting at least 1 Republican elected.
What kind of impact could those independent voters have in this sort of case? Is this, without strategizing for these candidates, one would think it would make sense for them to reach out to independents and say, all right, maybe you're not just going to vote for a Democrat, but maybe you can just vote for 2 Democrats and 1 Republican, or 2 Republicans and 1 Democrat, so at least giving them a little more of a shot in that sense as well.
Yeah, and this is something that we saw with the single-shot strategy in some of these legislative races. You know, you've got the underdog party in whichever scenario, and we see this in the single-shotting in legislative races on both sides of the aisle. But in this case, where Democrats are the underdog party, if they reach out to these independent voters and tell them, hey, you know, we understand that you're an independent-minded person, and, maybe you don't want to vote party line either direction, go ahead and cast any kind of split ticket ballot where you're voting for both some number of Republicans and some number of Democrats. If that is the case for any of these voters, then that situation leads to more of those votes being cast for Democrats, given that they're equally divided among all the possibilities.
Bob Robb, in his Arizona Republic column just the other day, expressed cynicism about this kind of strategy. I suppose he's not the only one, calling it an attempt to game the system. As you've looked into this, and I know you've looked at different aspects of it, is there a potential backlash to this kind of thing? Has there been when you look at the single-shotting candidates in the legislature?
I haven't seen any kind of backlash against it. I will say that when you talk to the Republican Party, I had one of the guys who works at the party there reach out to just discuss the article, and he has articulated something that I've heard in the past, which is that Democrats use this strategy more, and they would call it undemocratic. That is, limiting the number of candidates who might run for an office in order to mathematically achieve something like a better outcome for the for that underdog party.
Evan Wyloge is a senior reporter for the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting. Thousands of community members gathered for a 4th of July celebration in Colorado City on Saturday. The town lies on the Utah-Arizona border and is home to the polygamous sect, the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But there weren't any FLDS members there. Instead, the celebration was a chance for many ex-FLDS members to unite and rebuild community. And KJZZ's Sarah Bentry was there. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Steve.
So lots of towns have 4th of July celebrations. Why was this one such a big deal?
Well, for two reasons. One is that some of the people I talked to said that these types of patriotic celebrations were actually banned under FLDS prophet Warren Jeffs. So just being able to get together and celebrate in this way has a big impact. The other is that it provided a place for people to reconnect. The community dynamics are really complicated there. Lots of people were kicked out of the church under Warren Jeffs, and lots of families are split up where some family members are still in the church, others are not. And then some of the people who were kicked out moved further away from the town. So being able to bring together family and friends, in many cases, people who haven't seen each other in a really long time, was pretty powerful. I talked with the organizer of the event, George Jessup, and here's what he had to say.
People have done such derogatory and unkind things to each other that it's been very challenging for people to accept each other back. And this has been an amazing healing process for people because they've been able to come back together.
So that really speaks to the idea that this is more than just a typical 4th of July get-together.
The FLDS church is so close and insular. It sounds like this community of non-FLDS in and around Colorado City is actually becoming more open.
That's exactly right. When people think about Colorado City, they might immediately picture women in prairie dresses, brick walls around houses. That is a part of Colorado City. But at this event, there were, you know, maybe only a handful of people, a handful of women in long dresses. There were also lots of people wearing jeans, some women who were wearing shorts and tank tops. It was quite a mix of people. And then in terms of religion, there were some people who are in plural families, meaning they practice polygamy. There was a mainstream LDS ward's youth group that had a truck in the parade. And the organizer of the event, George Jessup, who we heard from just a minute ago, he actually isn't religious at all anymore. So in some ways, there was a pretty diverse representation of people there. And the other notable thing was that people were very open about talking about their experiences.
So where do you see this community headed in the coming months and years?
In some ways, it's hard to say. I got the sense that a lot of people were feeling a lot of shared trauma, you know, going all the way back to the feds raiding the community in 1953. That was mentioned at the sunrise service first thing in the morning, all the way up through recent history when Warren Jeffs was separating families and sexually assaulting children. In terms of the people in attendance, there seemed to be a strong will to kind of rebuild, reconnect, make the community feel more welcoming. Some people who have been kicked out or who left the community are now trying to move back into the community. I talked to Dan Barlow, who was one of the founders of Colorado City and was mayor of the town for 20 years.
It took something like 20 years almost for us to get in the condition we're in. It may take 15 or 20 years before we've changed this thing back.
So there seems to be recognition that it's going to take some time for the community of ex-FLDS or non-FLDS members in the area to move forward, but there also seems to be a real strong desire to do that.
KJZZ's Sarah Ventry. Sarah, thanks.
Thank you.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Phil Latzman. A recent report by a leading organization of climate scientists predicts a, quote, fiery future for the West, with Arizona facing the greatest threat of increased wildfire risk.
That report by Climate Central details the last 45 years of wildfire trends in 11 Western states and found six times more acres of the West burned this decade when compared to the 1970s.
It also concludes that in the past 4.5 decades, the overall length of the fire season has grown by an average of 105 days. That means in 1970, the average length of the season was typically under 5 months. Now it usually lasts more than 8.
And in the not-so-distant future, that hazard will grow, especially here in Arizona, with 34 more wildfire risk days expected by the year 2050. Joining us now is Dr. Allison Kenward, who helped lead this study for Climate Central. Dr. Kenward, how did you come to these what seem like dire conclusions?
Yeah, so we've split our study into two different parts, as you say. We've looked at trends in wildfires since the 1970s, and we've also tried to do projections to see what the wildfire risk is in the future. And if we look at wildfires across the western U.S. since the 1970s, we're seeing more large wildfires. And these large wildfires are also cumulatively burning more area. So since the 1970s, now we're seeing an average of three times more large wildfires burning every year compared to what we saw in the 1970s.
It would seem easy to point the finger at one thing, climate change, but is it as simple as that?
Well, there's lots of factors that influence wildfires in any given year, as you can imagine. The weather in any given year really influences the ability to ignite wildfires and to sustain wildfires. And of course, how many wildfires burned in an area in the previous years can also influence what's available to burn. But what our study has looked at is how have temperatures been changing across the West over the same period of time that the wildfires have been increasing. And we know across the West that spring and summer temperatures have been increasing since the 1970s. So we believe that this is playing some role in the increase in wildfires.
Playing devil's advocate, though, is this nature being nature? And there are cases where wildfires are good things, but is this a case where it's sort of artificial?
Well, we're not saying that wildfires are good or bad. You know, they are a natural thing, and there are some natural processes that can contribute to more wildfires. But where the problem comes in is that, particularly in the West, where the population is booming, we've got more people living in fire-prone areas. And as it appears, rising temperatures may be playing a role in the increase in wildfires. So as we look forward in the future, again, with more people moving into fire-prone areas, and we expect that temperatures are going to keep rising if we keep emitting greenhouse gas emissions the way we are now, we believe the risk for wildfires is going to increase.
And in your report, Arizona will be impacted the most by this increased risk. I guess it sort of makes logical sense because we're so hot here. But detail exactly what might happen here.
So in terms of future risk, we've specifically looked at the projections for how dry the ground is projected to be in the coming years because of climatic changes due to increased greenhouse gas emissions. So if we keep on emitting greenhouse gas emissions the way we have been doing, we're projecting that the climate in Arizona is going to leave the ground so dry that there's going to be many more days where the risk for wildfires will be high. That doesn't mean that any given year that Arizona is going to have more wildfires than any other state. What we're evaluating is how are the conditions for wildfires projected to change. And that's where we see Arizona, having this significant increase.
Dr. Allison Kenward is with the group Climate Central. Dr. Kenward, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Arizona, like most Western states, is undergoing a dramatic demographic shift. More young people of color are either being born here or are moving here from other places in the country and around the world. 2015 census data show the millennial generation, aged 18 to 34, is nearly 56% white. In 2000, that same group was 63% white, and in 1990, it was 73% white. William H. Fry is a senior fellow at the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program and author of Diversity Explosion: How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America, and he joins me now. Mr. Fry, let's talk about your recent post about diversity defining the millennial generation. You write about the racial generation gap. Before we dig in deeper, can you explain what that is?
Well, the racial generation gap is something we see now every day in politics, among other places. And that is, a lot of the older population, and I'll put myself in the older population,
okay. Because,
but not necessarily on this matter, that it seems to be a little bit concerned about the changing demography in the country, that it's becoming more racially diverse than they were used to when they were growing up, and somehow sees America changing a little too rapidly. Of course, the younger population, younger whites as well as younger minorities, seem to be much more open to these changes. We see interracial dating, interracial marriage, interracial friendships.
Well, since Arizona is the state with the greatest racial generation gap, what are the built-in challenges with that other than what you just said? I mean, is there, if attitude and perception are such a way, does that make it harder to either accept changes for different generations, different races to work together, for example?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a gradual process. It would certainly help if political leaders, industry leaders, community leaders of all types would see that the growth of the younger, more diverse population is a plus, not just in Arizona, but for the rest of the country. After all, if you look at the demography of the situation nationally, we have an absolute decline of white young people under age 18. It's not because they're all leaving the U.S., but it's because they're aging. They're moving beyond age 18, and there aren't as many white births to make up for them. And fortunately, as a country, we are able to count on our racial minorities, especially the Hispanic population, but also Asians and blacks and other groups, to fill that gap. So the fact that we have growth in our younger population, which is our future labor force, is because of this diversity that we have. So going back to what we can do is we can educate folks about this. It's a fairly simple demographic explanation. And if you're an old person and you want to have your Social Security intact and you want to have your Medicare intact, you want to have a vibrant labor force that young people are going to be contributing to and contributing to those kinds of funds.
Now, when it comes to voter turnout, it appears, at least from most numbers, that the most high-efficacy voters tend to be older folks, and many of them tend to be older white people as well. So as we're talking about this diversity shift, how do you see it affecting potentially November of 2016? Will it have a lesser effect because many of those high-efficacy voters are still at the upper end of the age range?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is where this generation gap thing may still be a pain point for our country in the next election and maybe the election afterwards. Not in the long run, because we're becoming more racially diverse from the bottom of the age structure on upward. And, you know, already the millennial generation, who are all now of voting age, are, you know, not quite majority minority, but about 44% minority in the U.S., and they're going to have some impact as well. But in the next election coming up, you know, there is this kind of divide, and the divide gets exacerbated because the older population tends to vote more strongly, and they are the ones who've tended to vote against some of the kinds of proposals that involve investment in the next generation.
Let me bring it back to Arizona a little bit, just because, again, it has the greatest racial generation gap. Do you anticipate that that would mean that potentially change, whether it's legislative change, whether it's electoral change, in a state like Arizona could potentially be slower and bumpier because of those dramatic differences?
Yeah, I mean, Arizona has the biggest racial generation gap from a demographic measure, you know, for kind of a unique set of circumstances. The growth of the Hispanic population over the last 20 years in Arizona, it was a lot more rapid in some other places with also big Hispanic populations. And, of course, Arizona has always attracted a lot of retirees from other parts of the country, again, a largely white population. There are these two demographic forces which are in Arizona in a bigger way than perhaps in a lot of other states. And, you know, getting into that idea of sort of the older population saying, oh, we like it the way it is. We don't want it to change too much, especially if they moved there from somewhere else that looked a lot different.
William H. Fry is a senior fellow at the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program and author of Diversity Explosion, How New Racial Demographics Are Remaking America. Mr. Fry, thank you.
Sure. I enjoyed talking with you.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein.
We cannot find a case that would support bringing criminal charges on these facts.
That's FBI Director James Comey at a news conference announcing that the agency would not recommend bringing charges against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for using a private email server as the primary means of communication with her staff. It may have compromised classified material, and that's the subject of his report and one expected out from the Department of Justice. For more on the fallout from today's announcement, I'm joined by Todd Zwillig, takeaway Washington correspondent. Highly anticipated, yes, all of this?
No, highly anticipated in a way, and in other ways, no. I mean, everybody knew that there was eventually going to be a recommendation and a decision about charges or no charges for Secretary of State, former Secretary Hillary Clinton, because she's running for president on the breadth of mishandling of classified information on her private servers. But John, James Comey surprised everyone by today, including apparently the Attorney General and the Department of Justice and the White House, by scheduling a news conference and prefacing that news conference when he came out in front of reporters saying, I haven't cleared this statement with anyone.
I noticed that.
Nobody Yeah, nobody knows what I'm about to say. This is an FBI deal. I'm not compromised, wanting to really telegraph to the public, to the campaigns, to the news media, and to Hillary Clinton's critics that he is under no amount of influence, particularly after stories about people like Bill Clinton meeting with the attorney general in an improper way last week.
So let's clarify. He's saying I'm squeaky clean, or he's saying I'm out of this, guys?
He's saying I'm squeaky clean. Nobody influenced us. The FBI is above the fray. There was a lot wrong with what Hillary Clinton did, but there isn't a case here for criminal charges. At least that's my recommendation to my boss, the attorney general, who, by the way, is the prosecutor. I'm the cop. She's the prosecutor. Here's what the cops have to say. Let's get into what the cops have to say, John. James Comey making it very, very clear that this was not okay, that Hillary Clinton knew or should have known that there was a great deal of classified information at various levels on her server over the years that she used it. Let me play you Comey here.
Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information.
And then John, James Comey went even further about how careless he thought Hillary Clinton was when handling classified information at the top secret level and above top secret.
There is evidence to support a conclusion that any reasonable person in Secretary Clinton's position or in the position of those with whom she was corresponding about those matters should have known that an unclassified system was no place for that conversation.
Is this technical language that Comey is using here? Because there is language in the statutes that govern this sort of thing, which could have triggered, if he'd used some of those words, we'd be having a different conversation.
Yeah, and you hear words like reasonable person and knew and should have known, and your mind goes to legalese. One point that Comey did make is that they scoured the history of other people who've been charged in similar, or at least legally similar, situations. He said that one thing that Hillary Clinton did not have here was clear intent to violate the law, no clear intent to make classified information open to hostile foreign actors, no clear intent to share classified information with anyone who shouldn't have it. And in past cases where this type of stuff has been prosecuted, that has always been the standard. So that's the distinction that Comey is making here, and he's saying while none of this was okay, State Department people, by the way, do get rebuked for this kind of thing. It is against the rules. There are administrative penalties sometimes, but in terms of criminal charges, no, doesn't reach that level.
So the DOJ then agrees with this report and we're done with it, or does Congress send it into double overtime?
Oh no, you're done legally with it, John, but politically, I'm sorry, just beginning.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Arizona's Department of Child Safety has 19,000 children in its care. The department recently evolved training policies to accommodate the growing number of LGBT youth in the system. As KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports, one foster group home is leading the way with a pilot program taking only LGBT teens.
On the door leading into 18-year-old Adrian Garcia's room, a pink ribbon sticker emblazoned with the word prince and a crown greets visitors.
Like, it used to say princess, but I chopped the little end off.
Garcia is very into DIY. He painted his initials in a Van Gogh-inspired motif that's currently hung up above his bed next to some doodles. A work in progress, if you will.
I'm building a mural of sorts on my wall, like a collage. I do this kind of everywhere I go.
Since Garcia entered foster care 4 years ago, he stayed in 14 different places. He says he struggled to find a good fit and thinks a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's transgender.
I just ultimately, whenever I was at a place that didn't accept or approve of my identity, I would get really depressed.
The worst, Garcia says, was when a caseworker with DCS unknowingly outed him to his mother before he could.
I did not get to tell my mother that I was transgender. My caseworker took that away from me, and it just makes me really mad when I think about it now.
But he says not all caseworkers are like that. Garcia was put into this group home because his caseworker knew it would be a good fit.
Hi!
Hello.
Come on in. Thank you.
Jennifer Redman greets me as I walk into her group home in Levine that houses only LGBT foster teens, where Garcia is staying. Redman's home has been open for almost a year now, and she's done her best to create an inclusive atmosphere.
So we really work on understanding definitions, understanding what LGBT means, so that our staff understand pronouns, things that kids would like to be called.
It's not just about being appropriate. It's also about being a family. She wants it to be a place where foster kids can be themselves, something they may not be used to in the system.
A lot of kids won't identify themselves because of either where they're placed or for fear. So it's really finding those kids and identifying them and then bringing them here.
DCS spokesman Doug Nick says agency policies instruct caseworkers to be conscious of a teen's sexual orientation or gender.
We know there's a fair amount, and that number in terms of identification is increasing. So it's an area that we are very aware of and very sensitive to.
DCS started LGBT-specific cultural competency training earlier in June, coordinated by Barb Nasco with the Foster Children's Rights Coalition. The goal is to have every DCS employee trained in 3 years.
This is a very pervasive issue, and it can't just be fixed in one place. It's got to really address all the professionals as well as foster parents.
The number of LGBT teens in Arizona's DCS care isn't clear, but Megan Arrigo at advocacy group Children's Action Alliance says many in her field estimate it's 10% nationally, but it's likely a much higher number.
We may not, as a child welfare agency, be screening adequately or asking the right questions when those youth come into care. So I think there's probably a lot of youth that are flying under the radar.
Arrigo says transgender youth have it tough, too, because of policies that place kids in group homes specific to their sex, like girls in girls-only houses, which Garcia, who identifies as a male, found problems with. But it can be difficult when caseworkers have to deal with 60 to 80 teens at a time.
Young people want to have a relationship with their caseworker. Those are the folks who are making decisions about where they're going to be placed, who they're going to be living with. So if you don't know your caseworker and they don't know you, it's really hard to find an appropriate placement.
For now, Garcia says he's very comfortable in Redmond's mixed-gender LGBT group home. Her LGBT-only group home is currently only one of two that Redmond knows about in Maricopa County, and she hopes her idea can be a pilot program for more group homes looking to address LGBT youth needs. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
The Scottsdale City Council will vote tonight on whether to purchase a little more than 5 acres of private property to include in the McDowell Sonoran Preserve. The price tag is $4 million. Preserve Director Croy Ekblaw says it's likely the most expensive price per acre for preserve land so far.
It's two parcels. They're elevated, looking out over the Verde Valley. They have views. They're fully surrounded by the preserve, and that's where you get an increase in value.
Most of the land purchased for the preserve so far has been state trust land, but Ekblaw says this purchase of private property is important because it's surrounded on all sides by the preserve, and the city wants to make sure it becomes a permanent part of the preserve.
Having the preserve being able to remain undisturbed in the long run is really one of the key goals, and so if we can eliminate access and the need for utility service, etc., to any given property, we see that as a positive.
That's all in the future, though, because for the time being, the owner of the property will continue to live there and maintain the land. Ekblaw says it'll be paid for out of the preserve fund, a voter-approved fund of sales tax dollars. Howard Myers is former chair of the McDowell Sonoran Preserve Commission and says while there's enough money for this purchase, there won't be enough to buy the remaining state land that the city of Scottsdale has its eye on.
It would be nice if we can complete the whole preserve, but that's something that would have to go back to the voters because while we have money left in the preserve fund, we don't have enough to buy the 4,000 acres that remains.
The city will continue to bid on parts of that state land, says Preserve Director Ekblaw, as long as they have the funding to do so. The next parcel is up for auction in September. The city of Scottsdale is preparing for another legal round against the online travel industry. Scottsdale and many cities across the country have been trying to force travel websites to pay taxes they say are owed to local governments. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes joins me to talk about this. And Christina, this involves booking hotel rooms, right?
Right. Like many cities, Scottsdale has what's called a bed or lodging tax. It's an extra tax on a hotel room. In Scottsdale, it's 5%. So say you book a room directly with a hotel. If the rate is $100, you would also pay a 5% bed tax, which would be $5. Now, if you book that room through an online travel site like Expedia or Travelocity, you might pay a lower rate, but you will also pay a service fee. Scottsdale argues these sites are booking hotel rooms, and so the total amount you pay should be taxed.
And how much more money does Scottsdale say it would collect this way?
If the city wins its case against the online travel industry, Scottsdale predicts it'll collect approximately $2.4 million.
Other cities across the country have sued, but what's happened with them?
According to the Travel Technology Association, which represents sites like Hotwire, Orbitz, and others, there have been dozens of cases, with the overwhelming majority ruling in their favor. The group's president, Steve Scher, says hotel taxes are for hotel operators, and that does not mean online travel sites.
They don't check in guests and provide room service. They are travel agents that connect consumers with the people who operate hotels.
Scher says if Scottsdale wins this court battle, it will generate more money in the short term, but thinks the area will lose visitors in the long run.
An environment where there's lawsuits and there's legislation and there's local regulations that seek to tax the service fees of travel agents, it sends a message to travel agents that the cities or the region are not interested in doing business with them.
And will they steer traffic elsewhere outside of Arizona?
That's a likely outcome. Absolutely.
So what's the next step in the case?
Well, tonight, Scottsdale council members will be asked to appeal the case if it reaches that point. We were unable to speak with a city representative before the show, but according to a council report, an outside legal firm has agreed to take the case at no cost if the city loses.
KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes, thank you.
You're welcome.
As the Valley is changing, it's becoming ever more important to document our past. That's the view of longtime Phoenix resident Derek Horn. He spent most of his career working in city planning in Phoenix and retired a few years ago as the acting planning and development director for the city. Now he's written a new Images of America book about Midtown Phoenix, and the show's Lauren Gilger spoke with him about the book and our changing city.
I've always been fascinated by buildings and by historic buildings. When I was doing my undergrad work at Iowa State, part of the curriculum included a lot of architectural history, basically equivalent to 2 years. I absolutely loved it. And so I've always been fascinated by historic buildings, old buildings. So the thrust of this book will be on the Central Avenue corridor, but also on that area's physical development, its architecture, and its buildings.
What is it that you love so much about old buildings?
I guess because they have a certain panache. They're so interesting. It's hard to describe, but you know, a lot of the old buildings have personality. Many old buildings are connected to events or certain places. And the architectural design, the amount of workmanship that went into them. You go into many old buildings, you can still see great woodwork.
Yeah, so it's the physical structure of it for you a lot.
Physical structure, and sometimes it's the place. Some important thing or important things may have happened at that location.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the history of Midtown Phoenix.
Midtown used to be kind of basically a rural area north of the Phoenix settlement. Farms, ranches, houses here and there. But as the city started to grow back in the 1800s, one of the areas it grew was north. But the city's business leaders, community leaders, the bankers, the elected officials, a lot of them lived in the downtown core, but many of them wanted larger properties, larger homes, and maybe what the original core could have accommodated. So they started to move out to the north along the Central Avenue corridor and mainly along Central Avenue. And Central Avenue became known for a while as Millionaire's Row. After the war, there was a construction boom. People were moving into the area, and unfortunately, a lot of the mansions along Central Avenue were either converted into businesses, and eventually most of them were demolished for office buildings or residential towers, mm-hmm. which actually that gives the Central Corridor in Midtown a lot of its character today.
So you live in this area, and you're writing this book about it. You're digging through the history of the place. What do you think it means, and why do you think it's important to know the history of the place that you live?
I think it's very important. I think it provides a connection, a better connection to a place. you know, people have lived in that area, many of them for a long time, for decades. You know, I've lived there for well over 10 years. Many people have lived there for 30 or 40 years. And I think the preservation of our heritage is important. Phoenix has a very rich architectural history. You know, many very talented architects practiced here, from those who were locally grown to Frank Lloyd Wright. I think it's important to preserve our architectural heritage. You know, we have lost, you know, some of it, unfortunately, over the years, but there's still a good amount left.
So you've lived in Phoenix then for a really long time in this area.
Yes.
For quite a while. Mm-hmm. It's changing so much. Our city is changing so much all the time, especially right now and especially in the center city. What do you think about the changes that you see, and what do you hope they include as they go forward?
Generally speaking, many of the changes I see, I think, are good. The city has an adaptive reuse program which encourages business owners and developers to rehab existing buildings, repurpose them for new operations, and we are seeing a lot of multifamily construction. Because of the growth, especially in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, a lot of housing stock was wiped out, you know, for office buildings and other commercial structures. Now we're putting a lot of that residential stock back, and that will attract people in, which will bring in restaurants, it will encourage businesses to grow. And throughout, we have a thriving arts district, you know, along Roosevelt Row, and we have a great cultural district, which includes the Phoenix Art Museum, the Burton Barr Library, and the Heard Museum right there in Midtown.
And as the city changes and grows, what do you hope that we know about our past?
I hope that we continue to talk about, write about, show off, preserve our history, not only our historic buildings, but also our culture as well. Phoenix has a great culture. Of course, you know, the area was established by the Native Americans, and we built on that. And so I just hope that people remember what Phoenix was, because that will provide a great connection and launch for how great Phoenix can be.
Well, Derek Horn, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Less than 2 months to go to the 2016 Summer Games in Rio, and the Olympic torch is traveling across Brazil. More than 12,000 people will carry the flame in more than 300 cities until the Games kick off in August. But the route also exposes Brazil's deep contrasts and inequalities. The BBC's Julia Carneiro went to one of Brazil's poorest states and met a 16-year-old torchbearer who's part of a sports project supported by the United Nations and is making her community proud.
Rayane da Silva Xavier is having breakfast with her family. She lives with her aunt, who raised her. It's a simple house with bright green walls, and the table is set with traditional regional food like tapioca rolls and corn couscous. It's the morning before the big day. She's going to carry the Olympic torch here in her city, São Luís.
It's all very new. It's the first time the Olympics are in Brazil. When the torch arrived here, the first person to carry it was a black woman. This caught my attention because usually it's only white people who get those roles. Black people are discriminated against. It's very important that I'm carrying the torch and I'm black. It's really moving.
We've come to a muddy outdoor pitch surrounded by small brick houses, and groups of kids are playing different games. This is part of the so-called Sports and Leisure Project run by a local NGO, and Hayani takes part as one of the teenage mediators that encourages kids to be here. She's now playing football with a group of children roughly half her size. One of them just scored.
We
go by their houses and say, come on, let's go out and play some sports. It will be fun. Lots of kids here start using drugs really early. Lots of girls get pregnant early too and have to leave school to take care of their child. The project helps keep teenagers occupied and prevent problems. Often there is nothing to do after school, and then they go down the wrong path.
The kids are now standing in circle practicing capoeira, the traditional Afro-Brazilian fight or dance. And I'm here with Eliana Almeida. She's the regional coordinator for UNICEF that supports this project. And she tells me their goal is to empower kids through sport and to address problems that are very common here.
The state has one of the highest infant mortality rates in Brazil and very high levels of illiteracy. We're always among the first when it comes to the country's worst development indexes. In projects like this, we try to reduce the risks faced by children. They are vulnerable to school evasion, to drug gangs, early pregnancy. They are excluded from many policies and basic rights.
We're now in the bus where Hayani and seven other torchbearers are being taken to join the torch relay. She has the torch already. She's all dressed up in a white and gold and yellow uniform. And she's taking a selfie of herself with the torch. Hayane, are you excited?
Estou muito animada e bem ansiosa.
She says she's very excited and very anxious. All her friends are coming to watch her and take pictures of her. I'm on the truck that's leading the way for all of the torchbearers, and it's Hayane's turn now. The previous torchbearer just lit her torch, and she's running forward with a bright smile on her face, being cheered on by all her friends, and she's running quite vigorously, like the young, energetic teenager that she is.
I'd like to dedicate my moment with the torch to all the children in the world, especially black ones. I hope to inspire other children so they may dream and never give up.
That's the BBC's Julia Carnero. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. By virtue of weighing about 2,000 pounds apiece, bison are used to creating a stir. In Grand Canyon National Park, how to manage bison and how many there should be has been causing controversy. That led to the production of a new report by a team of 9 wildlife biologists. One of them is Glenn Plum, who's the acting chief of science and resource management at the Grand Canyon. Glenn, the report concludes that bison are native to that area and have been there for thousands of years. How does that affect progress going forward on a compromise?
Discussion about bison in northern Arizona has been underway a long time. Archaeological reviews, ecological reviews, discussions about what they do in northern Arizona, and do they do the same thing here in northern Arizona that they do elsewhere across their historic range. I think this report brings together a body of updated information, looks at the established reviews that have been done before, both academic and state and federal, and brings them all together perhaps in a new perspective that, in fact, northern Arizona is considered as part of the continental distribution and home range, if you would, of the American bison. That being the case, the National Park Service mission is to conserve and help contribute to the conservation of wildlife.
Glenn, how many are there now? Is there an estimated number? And then is there a particular number that the Park Service thinks would make the most sense based on the amount of area, based on the size of these creatures?
Current estimates, as I understand, is there's between 400 to 600 bison running across both about 100,000 acres or so of the Kaibab National Forest and about 50,000 additional acres in Grand Canyon National Park on the north rim in the Kaibab. Occasionally, those animals still go back to the House Rock Valley, but they haven't done that in a little while. So if there's about 400 to 600 bison across that landscape, the collective understanding by both the Forest Service, the Park Service, and Arizona Game and Fish as the wildlife managers on behalf of the state of Arizona is probably maybe 200 or less bison ought to be running around that country as wild, free-ranging wildlife. And so probably we're going to need to reduce that herd.
People aren't necessarily looking at numbers. They're looking at these as, you know, as real living creatures that we have to, the word shouldn't be managed. It should be something else. Does that get difficult when it comes down to negotiating these things?
The stewardship of wild bison as the largest land mammal in North America is a complicated endeavor. This wild animal that was near extinction not much more than 100 years ago and has recovered in the last century to both being conserved in fenced reserves and parks and refuges, but also only a few wild free-ranging bison populations. Northern Arizona can be the home of a wild, free-ranging bison population across multiple federal and state jurisdictions, they can truly be a wildlife resource that the nation and states and local communities can be proud of, support, and cherish in a way that brings us full circle to being supportive of this animal, which is now our new national mammal.
How important is it for there to be certain requirements as it comes to hunting bison? Does that fit into what we've been talking about?
You know, the hunting of bison is wildlife. Actually is a very important aspect of their conservation. Wild bison that run through the greater Yellowstone area are hunted by Wyoming, Montana, on lands outside of national parks, on U.S. Forest Service lands. Wild bison can be hunted in Utah. The restoration of bison as free-ranging wildlife and bringing them full circle back to, on par with elk and pronghorn and other wildlife species, and finding a way that citizens can participate in that stewardship by participating in hunting them, and that helps manage the population abundance and their distribution, just like we treat other major wildlife species. You know, that's not incompatible with the mission of the National Park Service.
Glenn Plum is the Acting Chief of Science and Resource Management at the Grand Canyon. We've been talking about a report on bisons at the canyon. Some environmental groups have expressed unhappiness about the report, saying it reached surprising conclusions.
Moviegoers have been journeying to the center of the Earth for decades, but along the way, they've probably never encountered giant blobs. Scientists at ASU have, though. Researchers use the seismic waves from earthquakes to study the Earth's insides and have been imaging parts of the planet that seem a little different from place to place. And what they found on the Earth's mantle seems to qualify. Ed Garnero is a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration and a seismologist at ASU. He's been working on this. And Ed, what exactly are these blobs?
Well, over the past 5 years, these two anomalous zones, these two strange areas, one beneath the Pacific Ocean and one on the other side of the planet, beneath the Atlantic Ocean in Africa, halfway to the center of the planet, these things have come into sharper focus. And so our research, and that of many groups actually at other universities, has made it clear that these blobs, we call them for lack of a better word, are different material than the rest of the Earth around it. It has these continent-sized structures that are 150 times taller than Mount Everest. So these things are like 900 miles tall that we don't know what they are.
Do you know what they're made of?
No, and that's the one could suggest that, well, what do you mean you don't know what they're made of? The seismology images, it's just like if I slid you into a MRI machine and then the doctors look at their screen and find a little circle of a brighter lighted color on your brain image, you're going to ask them, well, what is it? And at a minimum, they'll be able to tell you, well, there is something in there that's different from the normal tissue. And that's where we are right now in our research of Earth. Now, what is it? Like in the case of humans, sometimes you can, after the fact, do an autopsy and say what it is. In the case of the Earth, we don't have that luxury. We can't drill that deep. We can't go there. So that's the place where we are right now.
Well, as you said, it's not really possible to go to these blobs to get more information on them. So how do you envision trying to figure out what they are and what they're made of and what their purpose is? I mean, what are some of the other scientific ways that you can find that out without physically going to see them?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are two lines of inquiry in my mind to do this. One of them is the scientists who study the chemistry of lavas that erupt are having hints of the chemistry of these blobs. The other approach is better imaging. Well, if we don't really know the shapes of these things in great detail, or if we don't really know the structure of the insides of these things, we're guessing. So better imaging is a big pathway forward.
What do you think that these blobs can tell us about the history of the Earth, the formation of it, maybe something about its composition. What is the significance of these things?
There's significance for blobs telling us about the past and the future. For the past, if these structures are heavy enough to be sitting down there now, that means they probably have been around for a long time. So there are even questions about forming the moon from something the size of Mars hitting our planet. Well, a deep layer has to survive that kind of impact. That informs us about the nature of the angle such a body might hit Earth. Looking forward, we're seeing that some of the largest eruptions on the planet, which happen infrequently, relate to the convective motions that sweep up against these blobs. And it's almost like a thermal that lifts a hang glider up along the edge of a mountain. Some of these massive eruptions, they don't happen that often. None have happened during modern times. Can erupt for a million years and cover areas the size of Texas. So these are of great interest to scientists, and we think they relate to the existence of these blobs.
Ed Garnero is a professor in the School of Earth and Space Exploration and a seismologist at ASU. The research has been published in the journal Nature Geoscience.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.